And welcome to The Farm, a podcast dedicated to culture, fair politics, and high weirdness in all its many forms. This is your host, Recluse, aka Stephen Snyder, the longtime curator of the Visa blog and author of A Special Relationship, Trump, Epstein, and the Secret History of the Anglo-American Establishment. As this is our Patreon section, I assume you guys know the drill now as far as the websites go. Okay, guys, today's guest is a repeater. In fact, he was just on here for last week's episode. He is the host of Program to Chill, one of the best podcasts active today. It explores business, crime, politics, and esoterica. Folks, I give you guys the glorious host of this thing, Jimmy Fallon Gong, who is with us again for this outing. So this is the second installment in what was initially planned as a single show dealing with two particular horror movies that have long fascinated me: Halloween 6, The Curse of Michael Myers, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4, sometimes known as Texas Chainsaw Massacre The Return, or gosh, I think it's got maybe a half dozen different titles that were used over the years. It may seem a little odd initially that I would view these two movies as companion pieces, but if you've actually seen both of them, it will make a lot more sense. But the long and short of it is both of them revolve around the notion of serial killer cults tied in with kind of an esoteric order. And in the case of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it's also heavily implied that there are links to the national security state as well, and overlap with general authority figures such as law enforcement, which Jimmy and I will get into in this episode. The Curse of Michael Myers also has a bit of that as well. You know, we find out that there's basically a druidic cult active in Haddonfield, that most of the residents of Haddonfield are involved with, and the head of which, the druidic cult, that is to say, is also the head psychiatrist at the town's local sanitarium. So there's some interesting things there with Halloween 6 too. But, you know, again, check that out. It was a great episode. You know, so these films both came out in 1994. They deal with this peculiar angle of serial killer cults. This type of stuff just, you know, was not talked about during this time frame. This is a good, you know, nearly decade before David McGowan's Program to Kill book was published. The closest you really kind of got to some of these theories was Chris Carter's Millennium series. Carter is, of course, the creator of The X-Files. Millennium was his follow-up, and I think in a lot of ways it might actually be better than The X-Files. But it didn't start to delve into this kind of stuff maybe until the second or third season or so. So, yeah, I mean, aside from maybe hints at the possibility, I mean, obviously, you know, with Maury Terry, there had been these indications of a serial killer cult and those kinds of works as well. But, I mean, Halloween 6 and Texas Chainsaw were really the first time these notions got any kind of like mass exposure, or at least attempted to. Both films were heavily edited by the studios, which is another thing that they have in common. There's just all kinds of shenanigans surrounding the productions of them, what went on afterwards as well. And it's especially baffling in the case of Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4, as we'll get into, because it happened to feature what were two of the hottest rising young stars in the mid-90s, Matthew McConaughey and Renee Zellweger, in lead roles in this movie. I'm guessing a lot of you, like, listening to this are probably like, oh, that's the movie he's talking about. What is this Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4 shit? Yeah. Exactly, guys. It's been pretty rabbit hole, other than the fact that McConaughey and Zellweger were in it, and that's unfortunate because there's a lot of interesting stuff present in this movie. So that's enough of this rambling diatribe of an introduction here. We're just going to jump back into the interview with Jimmy, and hopefully you guys will dig what we have to say about Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4. And yeah. Also, on that note, happy Halloween, as this will be dropping on Halloween. So hopefully these two shows have given you guys some nice food for thought for horror movies during this season. And I went into some of my other favorite ones from the early to mid-90s in the last installment, like In the Mouth of Madness, Nightbreed, Lord of Illusions, Wes Craven's New Nightmare, People Under the Stairs. So lots of food for thought here, guys. Definitely consider checking out the films discussed here at some point. They're all very worth your time. And on that note, let us start the show. Let's start getting in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4 then. So this was written and directed by Ken Henkel, who co-wrote the first one along with Toby Hooper, who was the director of that one. And they also would go on to collaborate together on Eaten Alive as well. He's got an interesting resume in general. Do you have any thoughts on him?
I don't have too many thoughts on Henkel specifically. I did notice that he wrote another film, Butcher Boys, which I guess really expands on the theme of cannibalism, which seemed interesting to me. What's your take on Henkel?
I mean, he's an interesting guy. I believe he had taught actually at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm pretty sure he had been affiliated with like the Austin scene for a long time. Like, even though like he's not really highly regarded outside of, you know, the Texas area, my sort of understanding is that within Austin itself and kind of like the entertainment scene in there, Henkel was kind of seen as like the kind of like godfather or something, if you will.
Yeah, I saw some interviews where other directors were sort of like referring to him as like very talented and just sort of like got screwed by the industry.
Yeah. Because he had been involved in these two, you know, kind of like art house movies. I've never seen them. One was like The Last Night at the Alamo, which he wrote. And I think there was like another one too. But I know both of those were like fairly highly regarded. But yeah, it's an interesting thing about, I mean, what exactly happened with him, because I mean, he did, you know, the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre with Toby Hooper, which was really successful. He did Eaten Alive, you know, the follow-up with that, which did, you know, pretty well also. Hooper, I mean, he got a crack at the big time with Poltergeist, and then, of course, he blew it with Invasion of Mars and, what was it, Leviathan or whatever the heck the other big-budget movie was he did that tanked. But yeah, it seemed like, for whatever reason, Henkel never really got, like, his shot. And then, yeah, I mean, when he finally got around to doing the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4, I mean, it was, you know, good, I mean, almost 20 years or something after, I mean, the first one had come out. So, yeah, it's just really interesting. I mean, at least, though, it seems like the guy finally was able to cash in a little bit. He's been listed, I think, as a producer on almost all of the you know, 21st century Texas Chainsaw Massacre movies, along with Hooper, even though I don't, you know, think he's actually contributed much of anything to them. But basically, it was one of those like, well, if you let us put your name on there so we get, you know, cred for, you know, linking to the original people behind the movies, you know, we'll give you a nice little paycheck for it. So
I did have a little bit on Cinepix, the film producer company.
Okay, go for it.
They, I guess, were a Montreal independent film producer company, and you'll probably be interested in this. They produced David Cronenberg's early films. They also produced Vincent Gallo's Buffalo 66. A few years after this point, they would be acquired by a banker, and they would turn into Lionsgate Films.
Really?
Yeah, so from Montreal to Lionsgate, and Lionsgate would go on to make a ton of movies, obviously, but in particular, ones that stick out to me would be like Dogma, Saw, the Saw series, The Punisher. No,
actually, I was just watching Under the Skin right before we started recording this, and I think that was a Lionsgate movie, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, also Fahrenheit 9/11, American Psycho. So like a lot of films that have some of the themes that are in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4. So it's just interesting that like that was the trajectory of the film producer and that they made other films kind of like this.
Yeah, especially with sort of the lineage going back to like the Cronenberg movies and what have you. So yeah, that is really interesting. Okay, let's see here. So, all right. So I've speculated that Hinkle actually intended Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4 to be kind of a black comedy slash satire of the original. Certain scenes appear to be outright attempts to parody counterparts from the original Texas Chainsaw. What's your take on that, sir?
Well, for one thing, I pointed this out to Dakota, right, my buddy, and much to my chagrin, no one dies by chainsaw in this entire movie, which cannot be anything but a joke or, you know, some sort of parody. There's no way they just forgot to have anyone die by chainsaw. Also, the film is funny, so there is, you know, a sense of humor, which probably supports that reading. Is there any other aspects that point like suggest that for you?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's definitely, you know, the whole dinner sequence, which seemed like it was intended as an outright parody of the one from the first movie, which is, you know, a rather disturbing set of affairs. Whereas, I mean, with this, you know, the one depicted in Texas Chainsaw 4, I mean, it's just, you know, it's funny. There's really no way else to describe it. And then just in general, the whole depiction of like Leatherface in this one, I mean, like you said, man, I mean, there nobody dies by chainsaw, but I mean, not like that. I mean, he's basically like what, some kind of like cross-dressing, like I don't even know how to describe it, but I mean, yeah, they took like this just monstrous figure from the first movie, and I mean, he really is just like a straight up, I mean, almost like, I don't know, like RuPaul wannabe or something like that in this movie.
Yeah, that's what they're kind of going for, I think. Or like divine, but like evil or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's something to behold, that's for sure. But I mean, yeah, the fact that you've taken just this like iconic horror villain, and I mean, you're, yeah, I mean, not even remotely taking him serious, is just, yeah, it's an interesting take, to put it mildly, that's for sure. All right, so both of these movies received extensive re-edits by the studio. In the case of Halloween 6, another cut exists, giving us a sense of what was included and left out. But with Texas Chainsaw 4, as far as I'm aware, a long cut has never been released. And I've wondered if some of the edits made in this film make it feel more amateurish than it actually is. Because if I'm not mistaken, I think they cut out like maybe close to 10 minutes or something like that. Do you have like any thoughts on this?
No, I wish I could see what got cut, because like for me personally, I liked Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4 more than Halloween 6 overall. And I would, and given how much more maybe like coherent and paranoid Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4 is, I can only imagine what might have been said that got cut, you know? But I did want to ask, which of the two films that we're talking about do you prefer?
I'm probably more partial to Halloween 6 just because, to be perfectly honest, I was never a big fan of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre franchise. I'm definitely much more of a Halloween man myself. So for nostalgia's sake alone, I've always had kind of a soft spot with Halloween 6. you know, like I said, I mean, as a fanboy of the series, it's kind of cool how the Scribe tried to bring together all these convoluted storylines into a coherent narrative. And I like the way, just in general, the film was shot too. I mean, it has very much that kind of 90s, you know, X-Files, you know, vibe to it, if you will.
That's interesting, because everything you're saying that you like, for those reasons, I'm like more into Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4. That's interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, I totally get that, because I mean, you probably didn't grow up in that era like I did. I mean, so like for me, you know, having grown up in that era, and like I said, being kind of weaned on like the Halloween franchise, I mean, there's definitely a heavy nostalgic feel to it when I see Halloween 6, whereas like I definitely tend to gravitate to Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4 from like an academic, you know, standpoint, whereas like Halloween 6 like takes me back to my childhood kind of thing, you know, like as sad as that may seem. But like so yeah, I'm probably biased though in my assessments of this, because I mean, I do agree that like on a lot of levels, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4 is a more interesting movie. It doesn't give me the nostalgic vibes that Halloween 6 does. But again, that's just me.
I think that makes sense.
All right. So, but again, Yanon, I will point out again, I do feel like there was almost a deliberate effort to try and make the movie seem less professional than it really was, because there is just some elements of the direction in it that seem really just hackneyed. And I mean, you know, again, I know it was Hinkle's first movie as a director, but I mean, the guy had been working around the industry for almost 20 years at this point. I can't help but feel that some of the professionalism was cut out in the theatrical release. That's always been my kind of sense of it. Again, I have no way of confirming this, but you know, well, we'll get to that here in a second. So anyway, that brings me to the next interesting thing about this, the involvement of Matthew McConaughey and Renee Zellweger in the film. The former is especially interesting in light of his later involvement with True Detective, which seemingly explores a lot of the same shadowy history as this film. So what are your thoughts on this, Jimmy?
Yeah, so it's interesting because my buddy Dakota shared an anecdote about Matthew McConaughey's, one of his, like, really his first leading role, or maybe not leading, but like supporting character role in the movie Dazed and Confused, right? Where he apparently, you know, he plays just like a, you know, people know his character, but like, apparently he actually modeled his performance of that character off of an actual creepy guy that he knew. And that famous line, like, that's what I love about these high school girls, man. I get older, they stay the same age. Apparently he was like intending for that to come across as creepier than it ended up coming across as, given his natural charisma, is what Dakota was contending. I thought that was interesting. Before True Detective Season 1, of course, Matthew McConaughey was in another movie that was potentially interesting called Killer Joe, which was directed by William Friedkin, where McConaughey's character plays a police detective who moonlights as a hitman. Thought that was interesting. But, I mean, I do think there's something really interesting going on where McConaughey is in two pieces of media that, you know, sort of break through, you know, and reveal or potentially refer to some kind of dark truths that, like, you know, generally don't like to be talked about. And, you know, in some ways, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4 and True Detective Season 1 are almost singular pieces of media in that regard. And then I wanted to run this past you because I thought this was interesting, because, like, then for him to show up in relation to the Uvalde school shooting, which was itself one of the most like mask off moments in U.S. history. Like, I thought that was really interesting. Like, I would almost suggest that it would be like predictive programming or something, except I really don't think that most people have seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4. And honestly, statistically, not as many people have seen True Detective Season 1 either. So I'm not sure if that's like actually speaks to anything deeper, because he McConaughey does seem to have political ambitions, and he could very well end up running for office. I know a lot of people have talked about that possibility, but like, he interjected himself in the Uvalde school massacre, arguing for gun control. It has me thinking, you know?
Well, I mean, it's a weird milieu that this film came out of, because again, like I was talking about before, Hinkle was a longtime professor, I believe, at the University of Texas at Austin. And again, this was a huge university in terms of counterculture stuff. I mean, it was really responsible for nurturing a lot of the Texas psychedelic scene, which actually was extremely prevalent. I mean, Texas arguably had the biggest psychedelic scene outside of California in the 60s, as hard as that may be for some people to believe, but this was the whole area with the 13th floor elevators and all this other good stuff. And it was a different kind of scene too than, you know, what prevailed in California, because these guys kind of came into psychedelia through peyote rather than LSD. This went back to the work that the anthropologists were doing at the University of Texas at Austin with some of the shaman and what have you that they were encountering. And that was initially what had turned on, quote unquote, a lot of the University of Texas Austin students. And there ended up being a fair amount of overlap too with the San Francisco scene, I should point out too. I mean, Janis Joplin famously came from this area. But again, there was obviously darkness as well. That would be Charles Whitman and the famous tower shooting, which was, I believe, in 66 at the University of Texas at Austin. And, you know, again, if you follow the saga of the 13th floor elevators, there's a lot of weird stuff with that, too. Rocky Erickson and the drummer were both institutionalized and subjected to electroshock therapy and just... There's a lot of weird stuff with all of that. So anyway, and then later, obviously, the University of Texas at Austin gets a pretty substantial film program set up at it. Of course, most famously, Richard Linklater came out of this. He was the guy who did Dazed and Confused and a lot of other very interesting movies, including Waking Life and Scanner Darkly, which is I think arguably maybe the best Philip K. Dick adaptation, at least it's up there. So yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff with that. But another weird thing about this that I will also point out is the sort of Discordian connection to some of this stuff, because Linklater was a big person, supporter of the Church of the Subgenius. There's a lot of references to that in Slacker. In fact, I think that his first movie, Slacker, if I'm not mistaken, the title was itself inspired by the Church of the Subgenius. And
interesting.
Yeah, there's been a lot of like overlap with that, like kind of University of Texas at Austin scene and the Church of the Subgenius. Because I think Ivan Strang was based out of Texas for a lot of years, but don't quote me on that. But Linklater and these guys were certainly fans of that. But okay, so here's where you get into some real mind fucks. Okay, so True Detective, the show, took its name from a semi-legendary true crime pulp magazine, also named True Detective, and a lot of interesting people were involved with this. One was Anne Rule, who had known Ted. In fact, she might even have dated Ted Bundy at one point, if I'm not mistaken. And then she later...
Weirdly close to him, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. She went on to write the biography of him. But also, Sandra London occasionally contributed to True Detective. Sandra London, who later, who had dated... I don't think it was Danny Rawls that she dated. I think Rawls was the one that she later claimed to have married in prison. I think it was Carl Schaefer that she had dated before he had come out as a serial killer or something like that. And I think Schaefer might have actually sent articles to True Detective too, if I'm not mistaken. But it was some weird thing like that. But anyway, the point being, Sandra London's also a Discordian. And she has also put forth some interesting notions about serial killer cults and mind control and stuff. In fact, her most recent book, Good Little Soldiers, all deals with that. So.
Also, interestingly, Dennis Rader, the BTK killer, I guess was obsessed with the True Detective pulp.
That's interesting. But yeah, so it's fascinating that McConaughey came out of this milieu in the University of Austin with this, kind of Church of Subgenius vibe, and then he ends up on this show called True Detectives. And I should point out too that not only was he the star of the first season, but he's produced all three seasons too, along with Woody Harrelson. So
Yeah, which Lord knows Woody Harrelson has an interesting family history.
yeah, and I mean, until
Oh,
the disastrous third season, I mean, it seemed like they were definitely hinting at some really dark stuff with it, because I think the second season is actually a bit underrated. I mean, it is a little confusing, you've got to watch it a time or two, but I mean, it's also getting into some of the same kind of
it's interesting because you're absolutely right about the second season, but I just rewatched all three just recently. And I think the third season actually gets at the same stuff. It just is a lot more circumspect about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I almost felt like the last episode of the third season was like almost tacked on because of the sort of backlash that was growing against QAnon and stuff like that. And it was just like, we've got to come back and,
They might have edited it to like go in a different direction, but they still fundamentally do hint at the same networks. That's a different question, but yeah, no, I know what you're saying. It doesn't, it's nowhere near as like in your
Which
face as
again,
the
it's
first
kind of
two.
interesting though, in light of what we're discussing with the edits though to Halloween 6 and Texas Chainsaw 4, because obviously then the creator slash showrunner Nick, oh gosh,
Isoledo or something.
I mean, he just recently left the series, and I mean, after the third season, and yeah, HBO is talking about doing it with like a new creative team behind it. So yeah, it does make you wonder, I mean, how much of his departure was due to the fact that he was losing creative control over where he wanted to take it.
Honestly.
So yeah, there's again, that's another fascinating parallel with True Detective, Texas Chainsaw 4, and the enigmatic Matthew McConaughey. All right, Jimmy, so let's get into the Rothman character. Definitely the most interesting thing about Texas Chainsaw. Well, I take that back. Matthew McConaughey's performance is pretty hard to top, but the Rothman character is up there. The guy first appears during what seems to be a recreation of the infamous dinner scene in the original movie that I alluded to a bit before. That's interesting in and of itself. But okay, so what are your thoughts on Rothman?
Well, right off the bat, the name very seemingly intentionally invoking the whole Rothschild thing, right? They give the Rothman character kind of like a transatlantic accent, whereas most people in the film either have sort of a neutral American or Texan accent, right? And this is interesting, right? Because Rothman, he shows up and he literally eats a slice of pizza. And then I wanted to ask you, do you get kind of like a, or did you get kind of like a Hellraiser vibe from Rothman regarding his elaborate scarring and piercings on his stomach?
I mean, I hadn't really thought of that. I mean, I was kind of thinking more of like the Marquis de Sade and the sort of like speculation that these guys are into like some sadomasochism. But again, that does kind of play into Hellraiser. I mean, it's kind of the same thing. So yeah, that's definitely interesting. And there's a good catch on the pizza thing too. I hadn't noticed that.
Which of course that's well before,
Yeah, this is
but
1994. This was filmed, so that's really interesting.
and then I actually found a interview with Henkel that I wanted to read a couple paragraphs from it where he talks about this scene specifically, and I wish I had found this for the episode that I recorded, but nevertheless, can I read that, please?
Absolutely, sir.
Cool. So Henkel says, being asked about this scene in particular, he says, "You're right. It is implied that the Illuminati or an Illuminati-like organization was lurking in the Chainsaw family background. Vilmer, for the listeners, that's the Matthew McConaughey character. Vilmer calls his wrecker service Illuminati Wrecking. Darla describes the organization Vilmer works for in Illuminati-like terms. And then there's the appearance of Rothman, a mysterious Illuminati-like figure. But at the same time, each of the implications should be suspect. The Illuminati, a notoriously secret society, would not be pleased to have the Illuminati name plastered on the side of some yokel's wrecker. Darla of the breast implants and of the purported head implants that explode on cue can scarcely be considered the most credible of sources. And Rothman, nothing of his behavior suggests his interests are those of a member of a society capable of controlling world events. Then Henkel goes on and says, you know, giving various interpretations about Rothman, he says, he comes off more like the leader of some harem-scarum cult that makes a practice of bringing victims to experience horror on the pretext that it produces some sort of transcendent experience. Of course, it does produce a transcendent experience. Death is like that, but no good comes of it. You're tortured and tormented, and then the crap gets scared out of you, and then you die. But could Rothman be Illuminati, an astonishingly wealthy and powerful man given to some peculiar personal practices? Seems reasonable enough. And it's possible the Chainsaw family could serve some useful purpose within the global machinations of the Illuminati. On the other hand, it's entirely possible Rothman teaches sixth grade math at a suburban middle school, home nights to a dowdy wife and an old maid daughter. Weekends, though, he's Illuminati man in the best suit and a hired limousine living out a Walter Mitty life. For me, all of the characters in the film, including the family, serve as the various forces of authority and culture. Rothman, or the Illuminati, works as an authority beyond that of the family, as a sense of a higher unseen power that informs the family's actions and worldview. I was much more interested in the Illuminati as a form of authority, and in what the addition of a Rothman Illuminati-like character said about the world of the Chainsaw family than I was about creating a narrative about a Chainsaw family Illuminati connection. So although you're right, the Illuminati implications are definitely there, all of that other stuff is there too. I stumbled on a volume about piercing of an extreme sort and scarification. I don't recall the title. I didn't intend to suggest that Rothman was inhuman. It was more to place him outside of cultural norms and beyond and above the authority of the Chainsaw family. I had intended that Vilmer have incipient scarification, but the makeup did not work out, unquote. So I just thought that really spoke to him exploring the themes, and he definitely seems insistent at various points to allow wiggle room that he is not putting himself in the position of telling us the truth about the Illuminati, right?
Yeah. And I was like thinking it definitely sounded like a great disclaimer on his part. Like,
yeah,
I'm not saying that this is what it actually is. I'm just saying that's one way you could interpret it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Like, protesting almost a little too much.
So, yeah, that's it's interesting to note. I mean, another thing, too, with the Illuminati appearance in this that does kind of just occurred to me as well with Henkel's connections to the University of Texas at Austin. You know, we've just been talking about the Discordian thing. Well, again, you know, the Discordian like to pretend to be members of the Illuminati as well. So in addition to perpetuating some of the serial killer cult mythos as well, which is also interesting. And another kind of fascinating component of this, because as I said before, Sandra London has written some books and delve into that. You've got people like Carrie Thornley and another Discordian who actually hung out with the process back in the day. So Thornley actually also knew Thomas Marshall, who was Paul Doerr's big inspiration for his apparently rape fantasies as well. So,
jeez,
yeah. There is this weird sort of Discordian component lingering in a lot of the stuff at Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4 that is interesting, and it also sort of begs the question too, was that a factor as to why Hengel picked the Illuminati of all things to throw in there? Because again, this is 1994. This is, you know, before the Illuminati had really become like a household name and what have you. You know, he could have just made Rothman maybe like a Freemason or something like that. But
yeah, that's got to be the main place where he would have, you know, picked up on that.
So yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff like that to kind of contemplate. All right, so the movie gets truly weird during the last half hour or so after Rothman turns up. I mean, up to that point, it's been a semi-conventional slasher movie with kids from a prom being picked off like one by one. But like I said, you know, now you've got like, you know, characters being killed by proto-military style drones, that kind of thing. What's your take on it, Jimmy?
Yeah, I mean, the first, yeah, maybe like hour or so of the film, like conventional, straightforward, other than the Illuminati on the side of the wrecker, you know, which you could easily miss, like not a ton to really sink your teeth into. And then in quick succession, essentially, Matthew McConaughey's character tells the main female victim character that, like, the FBI has the house wired for video. And then Darla, the character, tells the main girl, Jenny, that she has an implant in her brain, that the Illuminati's involved. Then Rothman shows up. And I really do feel like, despite Hinkle's, you know, disclaimers, that, like, basically up to when Rothman shows up, there's almost like evidence piling up that, like, would lead you to believe, as does Jenny, the victim character, that, like, the whole family is just paranoid and they're just making it up. And that's what Renee Zellweger's character is insisting right until when Rothman shows up. And it's almost like from that point, it's almost like reality intrudes into the film. And, you know, then you sort of, it's sort of a revelation that, like, this is all real, basically. So I just found that to be very interesting.
Yeah, it really is fascinating how the tone of the movie even almost, like, I mean, really shifts after, you know, the other, you know, after the first hour or so of the film is finished. It's, again, another thing about this movie that just makes it so fascinating and, you know, could make you wonder just endlessly what Hengel was really going for with some of this stuff. And also what the damn editing the studio was doing was about. All right, so Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4 seems to revolve around one of several compounds or ranches across the country housing serial killers and cults used to terrorize the nation. But it's also told through the medium of a horror movie, a genre that has long been linked to the creation of killers. How about the end, then? Rothman seems utterly disgusted by Leatherface. Is this a comment on horror's declining ability to shock and awe the audience?
You know, it's interesting because I think there's probably something to that. But I found it really interesting that, like, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre franchise was one of the main pieces of media to sort of popularize the concept of, like, a compound and a murderous family or cult. And then they were also, in the same franchise, one of the few examples I know that depicted that sort of compound or group interacting with the authorities, such as they are, whether that's the feds or what have you. And, like, I do think there's a meta commentary on, like, horror films itself, right? But I also can't fail to also think that, like, the film almost feels like it's attempting to pull the mask off of several things at once, you know, whether that's the Illuminati thing, and we can discuss whether that's even real or not, but, like, also the JFK thing, right? Like, the film literally asserts that this Illuminati group killed JFK. So, you know, there's, like, this idea that they're also trying to just reveal a bunch of truths all at the same time. I found an interview, another interview with Hinkle, where he said that he studied Ed Gein for inspiration on Leatherface, which is not super surprising, right? I think some people would not be surprised to hear that. But I guess he and Toby Hooper also looked at a lesser known Houston gay serial killer who had what Hinkle called moral schizophrenia, which I guess they were sort of trying to interject into Leatherface and several of the following films, just inducing a moral schizophrenia, which is an interesting idea. And then just as a sort of miscellaneous note, I found out that the working name for Leatherface was initially, they were going to call him Head Cheese. Thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely fortuitous that they went with Leatherface instead of Head Cheese. I don't know if he would have become quite as iconic. Well, I should probably elaborate on how I and why I had intersected that question there, because I mean, from my perspective, like the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre was one of the first slasher movies. I mean, obviously, you know, there's a lot of debate, I mean, as to what, you know, when the genre really began, but I mean, certainly Texas Chainsaw would be pretty high in the rankings is one of the first, I mean, true slasher movies. I mean, some may quibble with that notion, but it came out around the same era as like Black Christmas, Last House on the Left, a lot of that kind of stuff. And as I had kind of talked about before, when they had started filming Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4, you know, this was a pretty dark time for the horror genre in general. You know, this, especially the slasher genre. And I mean, like I said, you know, there was still a certain amount of, you know, push to make some of these high concept horror movies like Interview with the Vampire, Bram Stoker's Dracula. But I mean, during the early to mid 90s, slasher movies were just like the epitome of unhipness. I mean, it really wasn't until Scream came out in 96 that the genre was really revived, or subgenre was really revitalized. But so yeah, that's why I'm kind of, you know, from my point of view, I'd always had sort of wondered if this was sort of Hinkle's reflection on what had become of the slasher genre in the 20 or something years since he had made the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre to the fourth one, where it didn't. In a lot of ways, I mean, it had become a parody of itself, even though arguably, I mean, a lot of the trailblazing, you know, slasher directors like Craven and Carpenter were actually doing some of their best and most ambitious work during this time. Though in fairness, I mean, it was also kind of outside the slasher medium, but regardless. So, yeah, I mean, I think from that perspective, I mean, it maybe does make a bit of sense from there. But I mean, yeah, I also agree with what you're saying. I mean, you make a good point, too. I mean, I had forgotten about the intersection between the, you know, the Saw family and the authorities. But I know this was something that they had really played up in the first, you know, set of remakes that they did. Well, what the first one with Jessica Biel, right, in 2003. And then there was the sequel to that, the ones with Arlie Emery, where he was basically like, what, the county sheriff or something like that. And that was kind of a situation where, you know, I mean, he is the chief law enforcement official in this whole region. But then on the flip side of the coin, he's also the patriarch of this kind of, you know, family cult of serial killers, kind of overseeing the territory at the same time. So it's, you know, a fascinating dynamic. And I mean, certainly I think that the, those particular Texas Chainsaw Massacre films do hint at, you know, maybe some rivalries even. I mean, I know you had the, what, the motorcyclists that show up, and was it the second one or something like that, where there's kind of like a dispute between them and the family?
Yeah, because I saw the second one. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Like, yeah, I mean,
like a road rage incident.
Yeah. But you could maybe read into that, like rival gang slash cult, you know, maybe squaring off a bit over territory or something like that. Were there other ones where there was that kind of subtext as well? I haven't, and I, like I said, I'm not a huge fan of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre franchise. So I haven't seen the more recent ones, and it's been years since I've seen the first or second Texas Chainsaw Massacre movies.
I only saw the first, second, and then the fourth, unfortunately.
Okay. I saw the third one multiple times just because Viggo Mortensen's performance of the third one is just bonkers, out of this world crazy. I seem to remember there's some other interesting things about the third one too, but it's been so many years since I've seen that one. But yeah, definitely we'll have to go back and check out some of this again. There's a lot to take in with this franchise, certainly now knowing the things that I know now.
Yeah.
All right, so what do you make of the Rothman character telling Renee Zellweger's character that her ordeal was supposed to be a quote-unquote spiritual experience?
You know, for me, the thing that popped out the most or came to my mind was the idea that, like, the ruling elite, such as they are, really do seem to tell themselves that what they do is, you know, they ascribe to themselves good intentions, right? So, like, if you, you know, really, and I know you probably know what I'm talking about, if you look at Epstein and Maxwell, you know, they really did seem to think that they were doing good for the girls that they were trafficking, right? And this is probably because they were involved in similar types of relationships, you know, at a similar age, probably. And I imagine that's what you literally have to tell yourself to be able to do those sorts of things. I mean, we all know very few people see themselves as villains, right? I mean, most people find a way to think that what they're doing is good. And what, from what I know about, say, take your pick, right? Like Ira Einhorn, the Bronfman family, or Nexium and the Bronfman family, or really take your pick on several other groups and the Bronfmans or other elite families, I guess. It really does seem to be a huge gulf between what they are trying to do or what they're stating their goal as, which is to say, like in the words of Rothman, a spiritual experience, and the reality, which is people getting trafficked, people getting murdered in ugly and brutal ways. And, like, you know, I don't extend the benefit of the doubt to these people, but I do think that they intend and mean for themselves to have good intentions, right? That's just what comes to mind for me.
Yeah, I mean, almost everything Rothman says is interesting, but I did find a lot of the things in that vein were really peculiar because, I mean, of course, during the the dinner sequence, I mean, he accuses Vilmer of being a silly boy or something like that. And just something like, all I'm seeing here is just silliness, you know, which again is, I mean, certainly in keeping with like the kind of comedic elements of the film and just, you know, in general, what had become of the horror or the slasher subgenre by the point in time. Like I said, I mean, I think you could read comment like on multiple levels. I mean, on the one hand, you know, you had like the original slasher films like Texas Chainsaw, Halloween. I mean, you know, even though I never really have considered A Nightmare on Elm Street to be a slasher movie, it's usually lumped in there. But I mean, there was certainly Hills Have Eyes. I mean, I think there was certainly much more of a high concept in the earlier slasher movies as opposed to what it had become by the 1980s, to put it mildly, which was a big part of why the subgenre was on life support by the 90s, to put it mildly. So there is that kind of aspect. I mean, but then also, I mean, possibly also a comment on the deteriorating status of the elite and some of these cults and what have you as well. You know, this is, it's, you know, kind of a fascinating thing. But I mean, again, this movie was made in the 90s. This would have been the point in time when a lot of the World War II generation era of elites were starting to die off. You know, I mean, the you know, the New York Times obituary section was just littered with obits for, you know, OSS veterans and what have you during this whole era. I mean, that kind of thing. You know, you had the new breed of elites coming in. I mean, the ones who had not experienced the world wars and had seen what modern warfare firsthand could be like. I mean, maybe I'm reading too much into this, but I mean, this film was kind of made at the sort of onset of this sort of dog-eat-dog I mean, I suppose there's always been that kind of mindset with the ruling elite, but I mean, I think it was certainly much more pronounced after the Reagan years. And in some ways, I mean, there might be a comment on some of that as well. But also, as you're kind of saying, I mean, there is this sort of notion with the Renee Zellweger character. It's almost like some of this is intended, obviously, for just trafficking or sport, you know, I mean, a kind of sick joke to some of these figures. But I mean, you get the sense that, I mean, Renee Zellweger's character was also possibly being groomed, possibly for a position in the organization. And she almost kind of has that choice.
Yeah, the way she's talking during the dinner, like immediately before Rothman shows up, she's very much like just sort of yelling and doming them and like almost getting accepted by them. There is sort of that vibe. Yeah.
I mean, there is almost this sort of like feeling that part of this, you know, this ordeal is an initiatory experience to see if any of these people that have been targeted, you know, are capable of joining the organization. You are kind of left with the sense that Rothman is kind of giving her the choice. Instead, she opts to go to the hospital. And then, you know, there's kind of that interesting scene at the end where she locks eyes with that nameless woman on the gurney who's being wheeled by. Almost kind of, I mean, I always kind of interpreted that as, you know, that was like what happens to people who aren't able to survive this ordeal. But she was able to, which is why she's, you know, theoretically going to walk out of that hospital on her own two legs. So there is that kind of aspect to it. So yeah, it is interesting. Another thing too, you could almost see it as the elements of a lot of the, you know, I mean, the allegations for years were like targeted individuals and gang stalking and what have you as well. I mean, especially sort of like bizarre behavior that the Saul family displays throughout and what have you. I mean, again, this is kind of another strange aspect of this movie is, I mean, it seems eerily close to a lot of, you know, these kind of experiences that weren't really talked about a lot in literature until like much later on, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, someone throws a brick through Darla's window, for instance, and then like, not exactly the same as targeted individual stuff, but like, just the fact that Darla drives around with a body, well, a person in her trunk, and like people can hear someone in the trunk and nobody says anything, including the cops. Just like a lot of really interesting ideas other than the ones we've already talked about. Yeah.
All right. So obviously the plot of Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4 seems to closely mirror allegations made by Henry Lee Lucas concerning the Hand of Death cult during the mid-1980s. 1988 saw the release of Mori Terry's The Ultimate Evil. 1989 witnessed Adolfo Costanzo's cult making headlines. Two of these three were closely tied to Texas. I mean, is this an inspiration Hinkle was mining for the film's third act? I mean, it seems pretty obvious the answer to this, but what's your take on it?
Yeah, I mean, it can't not be, right? It's interesting, right? Because Henry Lee Lucas's claims remind me of several things all at once, right? So like there was obviously the spooked up training camps in the Florida Everglades training Cuban exiles and other forces, which, you know, would have somewhat aligned with his claims of like a satanic training camp in the Florida Everglades. It also reminds me of Mitch Werbel III's training camp near Atlanta, which trained mercenaries and the LaRouche cult, and Wayne Williams, and, you know, so forth. And, of course,
there was the training camp the company had in Kentucky around Lake Harrington that was like an outfit involved in drug and armed trafficking, mostly comprised of ex-military and police officers. And
was that the Andrew Thornton III
group? Yeah. They train, you know, people from Nicaragua and what have you. But there were a lot of the locals.
And Libyans,
also,
too.
Libyans. But a lot of the locals also swore that they trained, quote unquote, devil worshippers.
Yep. And of course, you know, all of this reminds me of Matamoros, like you said. Henry Lee Lucas's claims that there was a satanic drug trafficking ranch in Mexico, turns out there was, although of course Matamoros was supposedly not operating at the time Henry Lee Lucas said it was, I'm pretty sure. I really do think that the Matamoros cult had a bigger influence than people realize, like the average person, I should say. So, I mean, Roberto Rodriguez, right? He probably was talking in a roundabout way about Matamoros in his movie From Dusk Till Dawn, right? Given that
Rodriguez, okay.
Yeah.
I will point out, though, that Tarantino was actually the one who wrote the script for that.
True. And they were collaborating. Tarantino
wrote the script for that, if I'm not mistaken. But he did write it in the early 90s, though, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and it can't, even if it was Tarantino, right, it can't not be related, because, like, the Matamoros cult literally drank blood. So, like, the, you know, in the his movie, like, they're vampires or whatever, but, like, in From Dusk Till Dawn, there was, like, a high priestess character, and there was a high priestess character in the Matamoros cult, right? Rodriguez is from Texas. He definitely would have known about it. I'm sure he talked about it with Tarantino and so forth. I wanted to ask you, actually, Recluse, have you seen the 1987 film The Believers?
Yes, I have. I'm actually quite a big fan of that one. That's a good call, Jimmy. And interesting thing about The Believers that I will point out for all of you listening to this, one of the, in fact, I think he was actually the main writer on it, was a gentleman, Mark Frost, who would later go on to co-create a little show called Twin Peaks with a guy called David Lynch. Now, David Lynch gets all the credit for the weird stuff in Twin Peaks, and, you know, he certainly deserves a lot of credit for it, but if you've ever read any of Mark Frost's tie-in books to the Twin Peaks franchise, especially the ones that he recently released for the third season, Mark Frost knows a lot about the kind of stuff that we are talking about here. A lot. Yeah. A lot about occultism and a variety of other things. He is well-versed on all kinds of arcane history and spiritual practices. So, yeah, he should get a lot more credit for Twin Peaks than he has generally given. And you guys should check out The Believers if you have not seen it, because it is a fabulous fictional depiction of Constanzo's cult as far as that kind of thing goes.
Yeah, it's funny because, like, when David Lynch doesn't have Mark Frost, it's almost like Lynch is all about just, like, exploring vibes. And then when Mark Frost is involved, all the particulars of all the conspiracy and paranormal stuff that we have been talking about, like, clearly Frost is the guy with the details and Lynch is the guy that, like, makes it freaky, right? But it's interesting, right? Because with the movie The Believers, you'll see it cited, and you probably know this, that Constanzo was supposed to be heavily inspired by the movie The Believers. I'm not actually sure how far that theory goes, because if you look at the timeline, The Believers movie came out in 1987, and the cult was already active and, like, killing people and doing, like, witchcraft before 1987. They would ultimately get taken down in 1989. So I don't know that it was, like, a main inspiration, or maybe they just liked it, you know?
But yeah, it's just, it's really eerie how much it parallels Costanzo's cult, though.
It is in several ways, like the human sacrifice, the syncretic nature of it, but yet not, like, the way in which, like, it's not really about voodoo or Santeria. It's, like, a different thing, like, a lot of interesting themes in the movie. I wanted to point out that Henkel, of course, taught, I think he was, I'm always handicapped by my lack of geographic knowledge, but, like, I saw that he also taught at Corpus Christi. I'm not exactly sure where the University of Austin is, but I think I saw that Henkel was also teaching at Corpus Christi, which is itself not that far from Matamoros. Everyone in Texas knew about Matamoros, including Sarah Aldrete, the aforementioned high priestess of the Matamoros cult. And she was ostensibly a normal Mexican American college student in Texas, almost like a satanic Laura Palmer or something. It's just very interesting to think about.
Yeah, no, and the other kind of interesting thing too about the Matamoros cult was the connections they seem to have had to Chicago. Well, obviously they
mm-hmm.
the Chicago Mafia, but also I think several of the members had fled up there afterwards. And I'm sure you're aware of this, but a lot of the listeners probably aren't. But the LeBarons were also involved with Chicago in some capacity as well. This would have been Heber LeBarons, kind of criminal outfit. Which most likely did have ties with some of the drug cartels. I think it was one of his mothers or something like that, one of Ervil's wives, who had ended up fleeing to the Chicago area right around the same time when the noose was tightening on the family down there. So it was a lot of weird overlap with people going to Chicago during that time, which again is interesting in light of Chicago's whole sort of esoteric history in general, and some of the other darker aspects of it, such as John Wayne Gacy and all that other kind of stuff.
Oh yeah, the Ripper crew and more than one really weird thing like that.
Well, going all the way back to H.L. Holmes and the 1893 Chicago World's Fair, which also had this sort of psychotic assassin of the Chicago mayor present at it too, and our buddy Frank Lloyd Wright, he worked there for a while before he got fired and ended up disdaining the whole thing. So, yeah, it's rather remarkable just how incestuous this whole network is. Is there anything else you want to add here, sir, before we wrap up?
No, I think we pretty well explored these things.
Yeah, absolutely. But yes, no doubt. There is a lot to these two films, and I would once again urge you guys to all go out there and check them out, and especially the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4. And again, just keep in mind, this whole just milieu that this is coming out of, 1994, and this whole scene. This is also right around the time, I think it was a few years after Dazed and Confused had been made, but right around the time Linklater and McConaughey's careers were starting to heat up, and Austin was really starting to gain a reputation for making or being a major kind of cinematic hub as well. And that kind of reminds me too, that's the other thing that I wanted to point out, why, you just have to get the sense that the studio tampered massively with the fourth Texas Chainsaw Massacre film, because you've got this these two stars in it, McConaughey and Zellweger, who were just rising to the top at this time. It's coming out of this really kind of hipster movie scene and what have you, with you're saying, it's got a lot going for it. You know what I'm saying? They could have definitely, I think, turned this into something that would have been a really successful film. And then instead they pull it out after it's initially released in a limited run. They re-edit the thing. And then they just, more or less give it a very limited theatrical release and then bury it on VHS afterwards. And it just
Forever afterwards, you'll see on Entertainment Today. It's did you know that McConaughey and Zellweger had an early appearance on a crappy horror film? And it's not a lot of exploration as to what the horror film was.
Yeah, and it's this isn't necessarily Johnny Depp in Nightmare on Elm Street, where he's in it a decent amount, but he's basically just a supporting character or something. These are the two main characters in the film that McConaughey and Zellweger are playing. It's just, it really doesn't make sense. This could have potentially been, a Halloween type moneymaker for the studio, in the sense that it was made for next to nothing. And with the sort of star power that you had attached to it, you probably could have, milked this thing for at least $20-30 million at the box office. It just doesn't make sense. It doesn't. There's something there where you just really didn't want people to see this movie, which Again, I try to avoid jumping to some of these kinds of conclusions, but in this one, you really have to wonder was just some of the murky circumstances behind what went on behind the scenes of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, on that note, we will sign off for now. And as always, I want to thank you guys for listening. Good night and good luck to you all.
Baby, pick me up, out here in my wiki up. Sick and tired of fucking up, sick and tired of pushing luck. Voodoo blue got juice in it, swallow what I'm about to spit. Dunk got 86 from the copper queen for singing this. I took it to the goat, Jay. Hooray, my people there, they're feeling me. Down low, skin roll, more characters than Stephen King. Said I'm just working at the quarry, y'all. I ain't in a hurry, y'all. Come on, baby, pick me up. Out here in my wiki up. Stuck down in this stick. Hut is hot as hell, I tell you what. Put it up and knock it down. Moving on that bigger route. Come on, mama, jump down. Turn around, do it for me. Stick it out. Say 1, 2, 3, Geronimo. Jump, baby, we gotta go. Hands tied, blindfold. Jump into that battle zone. I said it's time to get the fuck out, cause they done let the wolves out. They're coming with that heat, mama, shooting up the street. Mama, fight or flight, adrenaline. You feel that little tingle in your feet. Mama, no retreat, mobilize your whole fleet. Hit the street, tell me that you good for it. You want peace, go to war for it. Say 1, 2, 3, Geronimo. Jump, baby, we gotta go. Screaming with me, scream Geronimo. Hands tied, blindfold, jump into that battle zone. Come on, baby, pick me up, out here in my wiki up. Got y'all on some Aztec bullshit, never getting used to it. Got bales of weed and catapults with Santum wet diffused in it. Shoot it over the castle wall, the Mikra can't patrol it. Off from Berlin to the Great Wall, the greatest walls are bound to fall. So legalize it, Vato, about a Genghis Chapo. Come on, legalize it, no need to advertise it. The weed cures the cancer, everybody, even Carter realized it. But pharma don't make cash money when we rock the stash, honey. Best believe they sooner take it out your ass, sonny. Come on, the man ain't getting wealthy with people getting healthy, right? Talking about AZ, talking about that BMC. We got no economy if we ain't got no enemy. The Popo and the BP, DHS and Army, Honeywell and L3, razor wires, UAVs. Officer, excuse me, please. Said I'm just eating my burrito, not the droids you're looking for. See you all on payday, see you at the Safeway. Bisbee lives on crazy checks, BP on that fast pay. I sing my hoodie blues, y'all. I don't make the rules, y'all. Just paying my dues, y'all. But I'm just saying, sorry hippies. If Great White Father don't make payroll, forget about your maypole. It's just the one thing that ain't too clear. I said people always bitching about the government here, but that war administration's our whole civilization. What?